Hey guys, this is Beth Golay. And before we get started with Marginalia, I just wanted to say that KMUW's podcast platform is made possible by High Touch Technologies, a software technology and business communications company that provides products, services, and support to all industries. High Touch brings the human touch to technology with a world-class team of industry experts. Learn more at hightouchtechnologies.com. And now, here's Marginalia.
This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia, notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to the main topic
in the margin of a book.
In her new book, Rules for Visiting, author Jessica Frances Kane has created a charming character in Mae Attaway. A fan of the Odyssey, Mae decides to contemplate Penelope's actions when determining action in her own life. Perhaps it's when we see Mae name a suitcase after Beowulf's Grendel, or follow along as she is guided by Emily Post's book on etiquette, or explore with her as she consults the OED countless times. Somewhere along the way, the reader discovers that Mae is whip smart, but also awkward and not exactly self-aware. That's also the moment we begin cheering for her. In Rules for Visiting, Mae Attaway does not stay home, but instead visits her four closest friends at their homes and discovers a lot about friendship and herself along the way. I recently spoke with Jessica Frances Kane about Mae and about her own rules for visiting. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. Rules for Visiting is about Mae Attaway, and she's a botanist who works at a university in her hometown. She moved back home to help with her mother, who was ill, and even though her mother has passed, she continues to live in her childhood home with her father. And when we meet her, she's been thinking about friends and the meaning of friendship, and an unexpected gift of time offers her an opportunity to explore old friendships with four women who she describes as fortnight friends. So maybe we should start there. What is a fortnight friend?
Yes, a fortnight friend to Mae is something I invented to express the idea of a friend with whom you could spend 2 weeks, who would have you in her home for 2 weeks, or you would have her for 2 weeks. It's sort of an old-fashioned idea. I think people used to visit each other more and for longer periods than we do in the modern age. And so the fortnight is sort of an old-fashioned concept. And what happens in the novel is she's thinking about this as she goes on this search for friendship in her life. The missing piece in her life, she feels, is that she hasn't paid enough attention to her friends. And so as she begins to try to do that more, she thinks of the friends she'll visit as her fortnight friends, and that becomes a hashtag. So I kind of like the idea of combining something old, the fortnight, with something very new, the hashtag. And in the story, that becomes a viral thing for a moment in time, and Mae is a bit confused by that because she's a skeptical of social media and all of its details. But nevertheless, others hear something in that that speaks to them, and that's part of the book too.
And, you know, she was surprised by the hashtag because it wasn't even her doing. I mean, she received this gift of 4 weeks away, but it was a fellow gardener who had spoken to the reporter, and then the reporter got the hashtag going. But then she also, you know, to her credit, saw the backlash of the hashtag, didn't she?
Yes, that's right, of course. So as a user of social media myself, I'm familiar with how these things go. And so I liked the idea that, as you know, people might embrace a fortnight friend for a while, but then very quickly there are others who say, oh, must be great to be able to have the means to visit your friends. And what is a fortnight anyway? And, you know, so there's a backlash that comes up online, a brief one. But that speaks to something I did want to make sure I justified in the novel, and it is why Mae's work is important to the story. She is a gardener. It means a lot to her. She works full-time as a university gardener, and I wanted her to have a job. I wanted this journey she takes to be something that really anyone could take if they have a job and some vacation time and they prioritize friendship. I didn't want her to be a person of means who can just up and go traveling necessarily very easily, and I love the memoirs that are like that, you know, say Eat, Pray, Love, or even Wild to a certain extent, these memoirs of a really rigorous journey, a really lengthy and rigorous journey that changes your life. And those are fantastic books. But I wanted to see if I could write a story that took a character on a journey that was more accessible, maybe a little gentler, and something that anyone could do. So
Mae starts to explore friendship or the idea of friendship, or starts to wonder about her missing friendships when she reads about an author who was killed on her book tour. And I was looking back at the acknowledgments, and that author really, you know, existed.
Yes, yes. So the character in the book is Amber Dwight. That she is based on the writer Amanda Davis, who in 2003 had published a collection of stories called Circling the Drain. In 2003, she was out on tour for her first novel, a book called Wonder When You'll Miss Me. And her father had a small planes pilot license and was flying her to her events. And in March of 2003, their plane crashed and she was killed along with her parents. And it was just a devastating tragedy. And much of the publishing world at the time was really shaken by it, in part because she was, well, she was a writer on the rise. She was beloved by many. And so what happened next was that the website McSweeney's, magazine and website McSweeney's Internet Tendency, very popular then and now, devoted their space online, their site, to become a tribute page for Amanda. And anyone who had known her or whose lives she had touched could write a tribute to her, a memory of Amanda. And so for days, weeks, stretching into months, that site just had tributes to Amanda Davis. And in 2003, I was at home with a newborn, and I had published a collection of short stories, and I was watching Amanda's career, although I'd never met her. And I really sort of became obsessed with this website. I read it every day for months and ultimately printed out the entire thing, which was a stack of paper probably about an inch high, and put it in a folder labeled Friendship. And I knew I wanted to try to do something with it. The tributes, as you read them, what becomes immediately apparent is that Amanda was so good at friendship. She really had a gift. It's just such a beautiful document about friendship. And so I kept that with me, thinking I would do something with it. Ultimately, many years later, I came up with the character of May Attaway, who decides that she wants to try to become better at friendship. And so like me, I give her this piece. She's inspired by the character Amanda Dwight, who's based on Amanda Davis, and sets out to see if she can become a better friend through practice, through trying. And that's May's goal for herself.
But then she also contemplates the definitions of friends, yes, but also neighbors. There's one point in the book where she wonders, how can we live in a time when social media makes us friends with people all over the world, but our sense of neighbor is shrinking? And I just found that so profound when I read that. What do you make of that whole, we've switched as a society, we've moved from our front porches to our backyards, and many of us don't know our neighbors anymore, yet we can be friends with people we don't even know?
Yes, that's right. I mean, that is a great conundrum of social media, isn't it? That we all have so many friends online, but we spend less and less time, studies tell us, with our in-real-life friends. It's the first thing that's cut, apparently, when life gets busy, is time with our friends, that studies show. I think people are so busy that they don't have time for their friends and neighbors in the way that they once did. I became fascinated by that, too, and started collecting articles about social media, because as I was thinking about this, what's interesting to note is that in 2003, when Amanda Davis died and the website became a tribute to her, that was a year before Facebook was launched. And so it's a site that's just words, no buttons, no likes, no comments, just words of friendship and expressing memories. Then as social media started to enter our lives, I followed articles about what it was doing to our sense of friendship. And at first, everyone was so optimistic, right? You know, we thought it was going to connect us and keep us closer and more in touch. And it sort of seemed to do that at first. But then just a few years later, you started to see articles that said, well, actually, studies are showing that we feel more isolated and more remote and we're more depressed. So all the health benefits that friendship allegedly brings us come only from the in-real-life variety, the face-to-face variety. I find that very poignant and difficult. You know, I enjoy aspects of social media, but I think it needs to be taken in moderation, just like everything else. I give a lot of this skepticism to the character May in my book. You know, May takes this idea that if there's a health benefit to face-to-face friendship, she's going to take that to heart and go and literally show up on the doorsteps of her friends and spend real time with them and see what that's like.
Well, and it's, you know, as you're talking, I began to wonder and I began to think about how, you know, May had this time, this gift of time given to her. And yet when she was like visiting these four women, I remember two or three saying, I don't have time. I don't have time. I don't have time to do that. And it might have been talking about gardening or I can't even recall what she was offering to do. Yet with the final visit, they're contemplating, you know, whether or not sloth whether it should be one of the deadly sins.
It's true. And one aspect of that, though, that's important is that I did kind of like the idea that there are two ways to visit people, right? You can plan a trip for an experience. I think friends do this. They'll gather somewhere around an event or go to a special place, maybe, you know, for a hike or a spa or, you know, something like that, or skiing or some experience, and they'll gather there for that experience. And I think it's easier perhaps to make time for that kind of trip with our friends. But what May's interested in is going to see her friends in their lives. And so in a way, she prioritizes that and she makes time for it, but she's appearing in her friends' lives just as they are. They don't have any special plans ready for her. She just wants to see, you know, where do they sit and have their coffee in the morning? You know, what's her favorite tree in her neighborhood? I think there's something valuable to visiting our friends that way and being able to picture them in their place and have a sense of their life, the way they live it. And it's not easy to visit that way, but this is what the book kind of makes a case for, I hope.
You know, Rules for Visiting received some inspiration from the Odyssey's Penelope, but it felt more like a love letter to a broad range of literature. And I want to get back to May in a minute, but I'm curious about your literary journey. What does it look like?
Well, I guess I've always been a reader from a fairly young age. I love to read. I was an English major in college, and I was always taking creative writing classes on the side whenever I could, but I never did an MFA. I instead just sort of kept putting myself in the midst of writing and publishing. So after college, I went into publishing in New York and kept reading and kept writing and taking workshops whenever I could. I guess like many writers, you know, I read widely and I'm very inspired by the works of many different kinds of writers, and how they handle certain topics, form and structure really interest me. And I'm never exactly sure how that will show up in my own writing, but I know it informs me somehow. And so I try to read as much as I can.
Well, and we mentioned that May is a botanist, and you wrote about gardens and plantings and such so eloquently, and it made me wonder about your relationship with botany as well.
Yes. Well, I'm an enthusiastic amateur gardener. I am not May. I'm not as advanced as May, but I have an interest in it. I have a balcony in New York City where I live, where I do some container gardening. Not very successfully, but I'm getting better. And I have a garden in Connecticut where we have a house, and that garden is also coming along, but it's hardly a... Well, a garden is always a work in progress. That's what I like to think. So it's an interest of mine, and I enjoy reading about gardens, and so much of that through the book is from my research. The trees, too. I've always loved trees, but I didn't know a lot about them. And as I began to read about them for the book, because I knew that trees would be important to May, and I wanted that as a thread through the book, I started learning more about trees, and now I just feel like I can't learn enough. I just want to read all the tree books I can find. When I was writing, I had a sense at one point that I would love to have tree drawings in the book if I could. And the artist who came to mind immediately is Edward Carey, who's both a writer and an artist. And so I wrote to him. I don't know him, but I wrote to him via his website and said, "Do you ever take commissions? Would you be interested in drawing trees?" And he said, "Send me the manuscript." So I did. And he read it and was very kind about it, said that he would be honored to draw trees for it. And he did. He drew 5 trees that open each of the 5 parts of the book. And I just adore them. I'm very grateful to my publisher for letting them be part of the book. So they are not to be missed, I think.
You know, it seems that May has some awareness about her own quirks. She says, "My father and I aren't great at doing things at the same time as other people, planting on the last frost date, reading the latest bestseller, eating turkey. I don't know if it's chronic procrastination or a dislike of team sports." Do you think she's self-aware?
I think she is. I think she's self-aware almost to a fault. I think we're seeing May at a moment where she has realized that she's perhaps self-aware to a fault, and she is trying to change. And so I was asked in an event if she's an unreliable narrator, and it occurred to me that she's not really, because she's trying so hard to tell you the truth about who she is. But because it's hard to do that, really for anybody, but particularly for May, because of some sadness in her past and the way she's lived her life to the midpoint, and she wants the second half of her life to look different. But she's trying to be so honest about everything that in a way she isn't unreliable, and yet she doesn't know how to proceed at the same time. if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, it's funny that somebody asked you that in an event, because she addresses that in the book, where she says,
right.
There's a story I've been trying to tell, one about friendship and friends and what place they have in her life, and one I've been trying not to tell about my family. Does that make me an unreliable narrator? To a certain extent, aren't we all? And, you know, I've had other authors tell me that anything written in first person from that perspective, that they are unreliable. Do you feel the same way?
I do. I'm so glad you read that part from the book, because I really like that bit. And when I wrote that, I thought that that really got to the heart of something. Yes. So May is a first-person narrator, and I agree with the author who said that they're really all unreliable to an extent. It's just their awareness of how unreliable they are that changes. And I think May recognizes that she's unreliable, and then so that's different. I suppose it's what makes first-person narrators so compelling to us, because they sound like us on the page. And I like that journey that you take with a first-person narrator.
So May refers often to Penelope from the Odyssey, but she also travels with a suitcase named after Beowulf's Grendel, and she is guided by Emily Post's book on etiquette, and she likes to consult the OED and contemplate if all of the seven deadly sins, you know, should be accurately considered deadly. Her thank you notes are so heartfelt and lovely, and this book doesn't cover a lengthy span of time, but May seems to really thrive during that time and grow as a person to me. Was it just there for the taking for her? Was the gift of time what she just really needed?
I think so. I gave her so many sources. I wanted her to have all of those literary sources in her background, and she's looking for insight everywhere, you know, not to forget the kitchen with all the friendship sayings that she wanders into early
in the
book.
Oh, that's right.
The neighbor who has mottos on every possible kitchen appliance about friendship, you know, so it's as if the world were pointing her in this direction, and she just has to take that journey. And so she does. And I did want to see if I could write a book that kind of earned a hopeful ending, perhaps not an entirely happy ending, but one that's hopeful. When I was writing the book, I went to hear the writer Ann Patchett speak, and she was out on tour for her novel Commonwealth, which is a wonderful novel. She's also a bookseller. She owns a bookstore, Parnassus, in Nashville. And so speaking as a bookseller that evening, she said, "What I always hear in the bookstore is readers come in and say, I want a book that is smart and funny and doesn't break my heart at the end. We need more of those." And I wrote that down in my notebook that night and thought that was really terrific. And I was in the middle of writing Rules at the time, and it was heading to a pretty dark place. And I actually sort of consciously made an effort to say, is it possible to bring my character along on a journey that is meaningful but ends in a hopeful place and not such a dark, sad place? So I really set my mind to that, and I think it got there. Readers are responding to it that way.
Do you have a favorite rule for visiting?
Oh, that's a good question. A May rule or my own rule?
Either.
I'm sort of fond of that, of the first one that May has on her list, which is don't arrive telling stories about the difficulties of your travel. because I do think that we have a tendency to do that. I know it happens all the time, and so that you haven't seen somebody for so long, and somehow the first thing you end up talking about is all the trouble of air travel and airports and taxis and whatnot. And so it seems like an odd place to start, and I feel like we should all just skip over that part and talk about something else.
I liked it too. That was a nice reminder for me, because I'm sure everywhere I go and people say,
it.
How are you? And I just start bitching. That's just who I've become. I hate that.
I know. And it's so common, and I do it too. But when you start thinking about it and recognize it and then actively try to avoid it, it's amazing. You know, it's just the difference of sort of taking a breath and choosing to say something else first. And then that can feel really nice. But it's not easy to do.
That was Jessica Frances Cain, author of the book Rules for Visiting, which was published by Penguin Press. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover more episodes at KMUW.org, through the KMUW app, or wherever you get your podcasts. Marginalia is produced at KMUW Wichita. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. And I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.